And hey, we're kicking off a new series today as well. It's called Final Hours. This five-week series is going to lead us up to Easter. And as we get going today, I got a question for you. And the question is, when's the last time that you read a book that you could not put down? You know what I mean, right? The tension is building and building toward this climactic scene, and the closer you get to that climactic moment in the book, I mean, you cannot stop reading. And I remember feeling this first time in my life back in the 1990s, so, you know, forever ago. I was in high school, and I was reading John Grisham books. Anybody remember this? I'm talking about like the OG ones, right? The Firm, Pelican Brief. I mean, it'd be 2 a.m. I've got school the next day and I cannot stop reading. Now, you might be going, 1990s, I wasn't even born yet. I mean, whatever, okay, fine. But I bet you have books. You have books. Maybe it was the Harry Potter series. Maybe it was Hunger Games, A Diary of a Wimpy Kid. I don't know. But you have a book that you could not put down. And this idea of like building toward a climactic scene, that's what this series is all about. Because, of course, the climactic scenes of the biblical story are right here. The cross and the empty tomb. I mean, everything in the story of the Bible leads to these critical moments. These are really the most important moments in all of human history. But in this series, what we're going to do is we're going to focus in on the final hours that lead up to those climactic moments. We're going to be spending roughly 48 hours looking at the last 48 hours of Jesus' life leading to the crucifixion. And we're going to be in the Gospel of Mark. And the way that Mark tells the story, I mean, he just does a masterful job of showing us how this tension builds towards this climactic moment. And he does it often through different groups of people who are converging in on this story. So for the first group of people, it's the crowds. And by this, I mean pilgrims, the Jewish pilgrims who are flooding into the city of Jerusalem. And why are they there? They are there to celebrate this annual week-long festival called Passover. And so everybody from around the countryside is in Jerusalem, thousands and thousands of people. And you can feel the tension building in these crowds. Because for many of them, as they remember how God rescued them out of slavery in Egypt, the Passover, they're going, is this the moment? Is this the moment where once again God will rescue us out of slavery, not to the Egyptians, but to the Romans who rule over us and oppress us? The tension is building. And speaking of the Romans, that's the second group. The Romans, they rule over the land of Israel. And in their mind, it's this group of religious fanatics that are constantly revolting. And one person in particular, the governor, the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, he's on thin ice with his bosses back in Rome. And it's like one more revolt and he's going to lose his job. And the way things worked in the Roman Empire, probably lose his life. And so I think he's just going, is this the moment? I mean, we can't lose the peace. These people cannot revolt, or this could be the moment where I lose everything. The tension's building. And then there's a third group, the disciples. Jesus' 12 disciples who are also there with Jesus in Jerusalem as pilgrims for this Passover festival. And they're just going, is this the moment? Is this the moment when Jesus reveals himself, finally reveals himself to be the Jewish Messiah and overthrows the Romans and restores Israel? Please let this be the moment. The tension is building because there's a fourth group who absolutely does not want this to happen. It's the religious leaders. And they're going, Jesus is not the Messiah. Jesus is a false prophet. In fact, Jesus needs to be eliminated. And they're trying to figure out how they can get rid of Jesus. And they're just going, maybe this is our moment. This is our moment where we can finally get rid of Jesus. You got these four groups with all these competing ideas and goals, some of them very good, some of them very evil, all converging. The tension is building. And then there's Jesus. And for Jesus, this is his moment. He knows what's ahead. Abandonment, betrayal, suffering, death. And this is what he is walking toward, and he is feeling the weight of what he must do. Tension is building for him as well. But what about you? I wonder if you sense tension building in your life to a critical moment, maybe a critical decision. There's a decision ahead of you that's very significant, and you just know that the choice you make here, it's going to have implications for the rest of your life. I wonder where you feel the tension building in your life, perhaps leading toward a crisis of some kind, a health crisis for you, for somebody that you love, a crisis at work. You don't know how this thing is going to play out, a crisis financially. Where are you feeling the tension building? Maybe it's at home. I mean, one of your kids, it has just been war, constant war with this kid, the attitude, the talking back, and you're just going, is this the moment where we finally, do we need to ask our child to move out of the house? And how do you even do that? Because this kid is only 3 years old. I'm just telling you, I don't think it's legal. But I bet there's some area in your life where you feel tension building towards something significant, an opportunity, a difficult situation. And what we're going to do in this series is we're going to walk with Jesus and his disciples and watch these four groups. And one of my great hopes for this series is that we would feel, that we would experience some of what Jesus did in these critical hours leading up to these climactic moments. And along the way, we are going to discover some truths. There are powerful truths in this story that I believe can guide us and direct us as we engage the challenging things in our lives and perhaps the tension that you're facing in your own life. But before we really dive into the story, I just got to set the table with one more piece. So back to these four groups of people. I want to focus in on the religious leaders for a moment. We got to set the table with what's going on with them. So if you have a Bible, we're going to be in Mark 14 today. And this is how Mark begins. He says, "Now the Passover and the festival of unleavened bread were only 2 days away. And the chief priests and the teachers of the law," these are the religious leaders, "they're scheming to arrest Jesus secretly and kill him. But not during the festival," they said, "or the people may riot." So these religious leaders, they've decided Jesus has to go, but they can't arrest him during the day because this is where he's at right here. He's in the temple courts. He's teaching. He's surrounded by huge crowds of people who are very interested in Jesus. So they can't arrest him in front of all these crowds, and they can't arrest him at night either, because they can't find him. Every day, Jesus and his disciples, they somehow disappear, and they don't know where they're going. And so the religious leaders are going, "We've got to get Jesus, but we can't find him. We need an inside man. We need someone who's willing to betray Jesus' position." And so that's the scene as we enter into the story today. It's going to be a three-part conversation. Part one is all about the perfume. So just in terms of timing, we know that the crucifixion takes place on a Friday, that Jesus will be raised to life on the following Sunday, a couple days later, and the events that we're going to look at right now, I believe they happen on Wednesday, so roughly 48 hours before the crucifixion. And these religious leaders, they can't find Jesus, they don't know where he is at night, but we do. We know because Mark tells us. "While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of Simon the leper." Now, reclining at the table is a way to describe eating dinner. So this is a dinner party. And where is it? It's in a little village outside of Jerusalem. This is what it might have looked like, called Bethany, about 2 miles away. So every day in the evening, Jesus and his disciples, they slip out of Jerusalem and they make their way to Bethany where they're staying. And on this particular evening, it's a dinner party at the house of some guy named Simon the leper. Now, this is interesting because in ancient Jewish religious law, a guy with leprosy couldn't host a dinner party. I mean, if you had a skin disease, you couldn't have people in your house. And so I think this guy is somebody who had leprosy. In other words, Jesus probably healed this guy of leprosy, and that's why they're able to have a dinner party at his house. And I just think it's kind of funny that Mark, writing probably two decades or so after these events, calls this guy Simon the leper, even though he was healed way back then. And if I'm Simon, I'm like, really? I mean, come on. Still with the leper? I mean, I get leprosy one time, and I'm Simon the leper forever. That's not relevant, but I find it entertaining. So anyway, they're having dinner at this guy's house who's a big fan of Jesus. In fact, everybody at this dinner is very pro-Jesus. So this is a safe environment for Jesus. Everybody is pro-Jesus. Well, until something very interesting happens at this dinner. While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came in with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Now, it's possible that you know this story, you're familiar with this story, but let me just ask you to just stop and put yourself at the table. I mean, put yourself there and try to feel this event, because this is crazy. I mean, it's just outrageous. This woman, she comes in. Was she invited? I mean, she a party crasher? We don't know. We don't even know her name. But she walks in. She's got this jar of very expensive perfume, Mark says, that's called nard, which, interestingly, nard is probably the least expensive sounding word I've ever heard. But it's very expensive perfume. And she takes this thing, she breaks it, and pours it all over Jesus. I mean, it's just wild. I mean, can you imagine over dinner just watching this go down? And there's really only one way to describe it. It's over the top, it's outrageous, and the way that the dinner party responds to this woman just raises the level of how outrageous this whole thing is. Some who were present there, and keep in mind this includes the disciples, some of those who were present were saying indignantly, they're very mad to one another, why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor, and they rebuked her harshly. This perfume is worth more than a year's wages. That's wild. I mean, translate that to today's economy. I'm just going to take a guess. What, 50 grand? Can you imagine a $50,000 bottle of perfume? And she just breaks it and pours it all over Jesus' head. And they are angry. And what do? Rebuked her harshly. Have you ever been rebuked harshly? In public? That's a memory that tends to stick with you. What were you thinking? How could you? I mean, they're yelling at this woman. The whole scene, I mean, what she does is outrageous. How they respond to her is outrageous. And what about Jesus? I mean, he's the guy that's just had $50,000 in very luxurious essential oils poured on his head. I mean, how is he processing this? Well, he tells us. Leave her alone, said Jesus. Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. Jesus rebukes the rebukers. And he says, she has done a beautiful thing to me. And what does he mean by this? What about this is beautiful? He says, she did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. You see, this luxurious, extremely expensive perfume, this was for burying people. This was the kind of perfume you put on a body before you put it in the tomb. She's the only one who knows that he's about to die. This entire dinner party, she's the only one who sees Jesus for who he really is. And think about this. Three different times, Jesus tried to explain to his disciples very clearly what was ahead. that he was going to be betrayed, that he was going to be, that he would suffer at the hands of the religious leaders, and that he would be killed. Three different times he tried to explain to them, and each time, no, that's not going to happen. No, they couldn't accept it. They couldn't hear him. They were unwilling to believe what he said. And just think about what Jesus is carrying. He knows what is ahead. Abandonment, betrayal, suffering, death. He knows it, and he's all alone. His closest friends cannot accept it. He's carrying this massive weight all alone, and here comes this woman into this dinner party, and she goes, I know who you are, and I know what you must do. And she pours this perfume out on him, and Jesus says, she has done a beautiful thing to me. And it just strikes me, if you want to do something beautiful for Jesus, see him, hear him. I mean, really listen to his words, because that's what she did. She was the only one who really saw him and really heard him and embraced him for who he truly was. And how did she respond to that? She brought the most expensive, the most precious, the most extravagant gifts. And so let's just put this on the screen. When you see the infinite worth of Jesus, no gift is too extravagant. When you see the infinite worth of Jesus, this is God himself. This is the creator. This is the one who holds the universe together, the supreme being, the one of infinite worth, who humbled himself, became a human being, and endured all that the worst of this world can offer. Loneliness, rejection, anxiety, physical pain, suffering, death. Jesus endured all of it. Why? Why would he do that? He chose it to buy us back, to buy you back. He endured all of it to rescue you and restore his creation. When you see the infinite worth of Jesus, no gift is too extravagant. No worship is sufficient. No obedience is too demanding. No sacrifice is too great. When you see the infinite worth of Jesus, and I think that's what she was beginning to see in him, and so she brought the very best that she had. Now, let's return once again to this question I asked earlier. Where do you feel the tension in your life? Where do you feel it rising? You have a critical decision ahead of you. You have an opportunity ahead of you. You have something difficult ahead of you. Something about what this woman does here, I think, is so important for each one of us. And I'll just put it to you like this. Whatever is happening in your life, the most important thing that you can do is focus your attention on Jesus. Really see him. Really hear him and listen to him. Embrace him for who he actually is, because this will give you the perspective that you need. This woman, she's the only one who sees reality. She's the only one who embraces what's actually going on. She is the only one who has real perspective. And so focus your attention on Jesus. She shows up with this incredibly luxurious gift, and Jesus has one more thing to say about her. He says, truly I tell you, whenever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. And it's true. I mean, here we are, over 2,000 years later. And we're talking about this woman. She's not named in the text, but we're talking about the incredible gift that she brought because she saw Jesus. But not everybody at this dinner party is happy about what she did. Not everybody at this dinner party is happy about how Jesus responded to her. In fact, one of Jesus' disciples, he is done. He goes, I'm out. That's it. I am finished. And he is at a breaking point. And so part two today is called The Betrayal. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. Now, this should hit us like a punch in the gut. One of the 12. handpicked by Jesus. Inner circle. 3 years of walking with him, eating with him, listening to him, serving with him. One of the most trusted and closest says, I'm out, I'm done. And he goes and he betrays Jesus. And my big question is, why? I mean, why would Judas do this? I just have to believe that there was a time when Judas was absolutely captivated by Jesus. There was a moment when he left his old life behind to follow Jesus, to apprentice himself to Jesus, believing that Jesus was the Messiah, the one. So how do you go from follower to betrayer? I mean, how does this happen? And widen the question out. Why do people bail on Jesus? I mean, you know people. We've all got someone in our lives that they were all in and either quietly or loudly, I'm out, I'm out. Why do people bail on Jesus? I think this is an important question for us to wrestle with. So back to Judas. Let's start with Judas. Why did he bail? I think it's as simple as this right here. Jesus did not do what Judas wanted him to do. At the dinner party, Jesus doesn't respond how Judas thinks that he should. But that's a microcosm of the greater issue, is that Judas had an expectation of what Jesus should do and what he should be like. This is what the Messiah is supposed to do. And when Jesus didn't deliver, Judas said, I'm out. And he betrayed. Jesus didn't do what Judas wanted him to do. And it's really two words. Unmet expectations. Jesus did not meet Judas's expectation. And these two words, I think they really describe what happened with Judas. And I think they're two words that we need to think about in our own relationship with Jesus. So let's talk about unmet expectations. Let me introduce you to a couple here. That's me. And my wife, Katie, back in the day before we got married, it's black and white because it's from the 1900s. So those of you who are younger, you can use your imagination. So this picture was taken when Katie and I were engaged, when we were preparing to get married. And one of the things that we did as part of like pre-marriage counseling is we read a book together. It was called Saving Your Marriage Before It Starts. And it included an exercise about expectations. Now, if you participate in our Marriage Start class here at Ada Bible Church, you're going to experience the same really, really helpful exercise. But here's what it was, all about expectations. There's a long list of questions to get at what you are expecting out of this marriage relationship. All kinds of questions. And the way the exercise went is I went over here and I wrote down my answers to the questions, and then Katie went over here and she wrote down her answers to the questions, and then we got back together, probably at Caribou Coffee, because that's where we like to hang out, and discuss all the different answers. And what were the questions? Well, there were questions like, who's going to do the cooking? And who's going to mow the grass? Who's going to handle the finances? Do you want to have kids? How many kids? When are you going to start having kids? How often do you expect to go on vacation? How often do you expect to experience intimacy in your relationship? What kind of stuff are you going to do for birthdays? How much are you going to spend on birthdays? What are you going to do for Christmas? Whose family? I mean, all kinds of questions. And we answered them, and we got back together, and we discussed them. And it might shock you to discover that they weren't all the same. They were not all the same answers. But this exercise was incredibly helpful for us in just talking through what we were expecting out of this relationship. And here's something that is so true. So many marriages end up in challenging space because of unmet expectations. Often unexpressed expectations. It is true in a marriage, and it is true in your relationship with God. Which leads me to what I think is a really important question for us, and it's this: what will you do when Jesus doesn't do what you want him to do? What are you going to do when Jesus doesn't meet your expectations? What are you going to do when you pray and pray and pray and you still don't get the job? You don't get into the school? What are you going to do when you pray and pray and pray and God doesn't heal? And God doesn't change your daughter's heart. God doesn't change your husband's heart. What are you going to do when you pray and pray and pray and you remain single? Or that thing that you care about so much, that you've invested so much into, it fails. What are you going to do when you pray and pray and pray and still you can't get pregnant? What will you do when Jesus doesn't do what you want him to do? It's unmet expectations. And I think this is at the heart of why Judas betrayed. Because at the end of the day, for Judas, I think it was this: what's in it for me? What's in it for me? And the moment that he realized that Jesus wasn't going to deliver, he bailed. And Pastor Jeff has given us through the years just incredible statements to really help frame this. And it's this right here. We don't follow Jesus to get where we are going. We follow Jesus to get where he is going. And I tried to improve on this language. I couldn't do it. So Jeff is still the master. I don't know what to say. But I think these two statements are just so powerful for us to think through, because I think a lot of us are stuck up here. And I think that's exactly where Judas was at. Now, I just think this weekend could be a weekend where you surrender in a new and fresh way to God. Just realizing, I've been asking you, God, to get on board with my desires, my goals, my hopes, and my dreams. And I need to recognize that you are the Lord, Jesus. You are King, and I need to get myself aligned with your hopes, your goals, and your mission. It's so easy to get off track here. There are times when we just need a fresh surrender to King Jesus. It's about unmet expectations and really about who is following who. And we are following Jesus. So Judas, he decides, I'm out. Jesus doesn't meet his expectations, and he bails, and he goes to the religious leaders. And before we move on to the third scene, I need you to hear these words and feel these words. They, the religious leaders, were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So he watched for an opportunity to hand them over. They were delighted. They're so happy to have somebody ready to betray Jesus. It's heartbreaking. And you can just feel the tension building, because now it's just a matter of time before Judas hands over Jesus. But as we move to part three, the secret dinner, understand Jesus, he's not ready to be arrested. Not yet. So the scene shifts. We move into Thursday. And so maybe Thursday morning, maybe early afternoon, but the disciples have a really pretty straightforward question for Jesus. They ask him, hey, where do you want to celebrate the Passover meal? Now, we know this as the Last Supper, but they had no idea that this was the Last Supper. I mean, that was not an idea that would come into their mind. They had no idea this was the last meal they would share with Jesus. For them, this was the Passover meal. It was part of that Passover festival where everybody that had flooded into Jerusalem, they would break off into their family groups and they would eat this meal together, where they would remember how God had rescued them out of slavery in Egypt. And they would eat bread that was baked without yeast. They would eat roasted lamb, and they would remember and celebrate. And so the disciples are going, hey, that meal, where do you want to celebrate that meal? Pretty straightforward question. Jesus gives them a very not straightforward answer. And I just picture him leaning in, looking around, whispering, because he says, go into the city. You're going to see a guy carrying a jar of water. Follow him, not too closely. Follow him. When he goes into a house, you go to the owner of that house, and you ask him, the teacher wants to know where the guest room is. He's going to lead you upstairs. That's the room. Set up the dinner there. What is this, a spy movie? Right? I mean, you kind of expect Jesus to go, this message will self-destruct in 5 seconds. And the thing is, it kind of is a spy movie. Because what is going on here? I think there's actually a pretty simple explanation. Jesus is not ready to be arrested yet. It's very important to him that he get the opportunity to celebrate this final Passover with his disciples. And so he sets up this kind of elaborate deal where nobody knows where dinner's going to be. Judas isn't going to know where dinner is until Judas shows up at dinner. In other words, he can't tell the religious leaders, this is where Jesus will be. Send the guards, you can arrest him here. He doesn't know. And so it's like this cat and mouse game, and you can feel the tension rising toward this climactic scene, and it continues to rise into the dinner itself. When evening came, Jesus arrived with the 12. And while they were reclining at the table eating, he said, truly I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me. Gut punch. One of you will betray me. And this meal that they're eating, I mean, don't picture, you know, a restaurant in America. Picture Middle Eastern, ancient world. I mean, everybody's dipping out of the same cup. They're bumping hands together. This is close. It's intimate. And in the ancient world, to share a meal was to share life together, to be aligned with each other. And it's just this picture of how close these guys are. 3 years, and Jesus goes, this one of you is going to betray me. And they are absolutely distraught at these words. They were saddened. And one by one, they said to him, surely you don't mean me. It's one of the 12, he replied, one who dips bread into the bowl with me. And I just think in this moment, these guys are going, who caved? Who caved? Judas knew where to go, didn't he? When he decided, I'm done, he knew who to talk to. Why? Because all these guys knew the religious leaders were after Jesus. And how many of them had been approached? Listen, you give us Jesus, you'll never have to worry about a thing the rest of your life. We'll take care of you. How many of them were approached? I think they're just going, who caved? They're looking around the room. Which one of you caved? I mean, they are distraught. And in this moment, you just feel like everything is falling apart. It's cascading out of control. It's spinning out of control. I mean, the shepherds of God's people, they are scheming to kill their Messiah. And there's a betrayer at the table. Everything is going wrong. It's spinning out of control. The train is off the tracks. And at this moment is when we get these words. While they were eating, Jesus took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, take it. This is my body. And then he took a cup. And when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they drank from it. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. It's at this tense, distraught moment that Jesus says, my body's going to be broken. My blood is going to be poured out for you. And there's just so many layers here. I mean, this is the Passover meal, where they remember this spotless lamb that was killed, blood shed, so that the blood could be spread over the doorways of the people so that God's judgment would pass over them. And Jesus is going, I am the Passover lamb. And it's not just that God is going to rescue people out of slavery in Egypt. No, through the cross and through the resurrection, God is going to use that to rescue people out of slavery to sin, out of slavery to death itself. God is doing something so massive at this moment with Jesus. But there at the table, it absolutely felt like everything was falling apart. I mean, back to these four groups of people and all their competing desires and wishes and everything that they wanted, some of which was just plain wrong. I think it's just so important for us to recognize that God was using all of it, the chaos of all of it, to pull together for his purposes, to complete his purpose in the world, which was the rescue and restoration of all things. And so my point in bringing this up is that when it felt like everything was spinning out of control, God was absolutely in control, on his throne, fulfilling his purpose, the rescue and restoration of his creation. That was true then, and it's true now. Again, back to your life, back to my life. I don't know what feels like tension is just building and building towards something critical, an opportunity, a difficult situation, but whatever it is, even if it feels like it is spinning out of control, I just want to tell you, God is absolutely in control. He is on his throne, and he has a purpose, and he is at work. In fact, the words of Paul here, I think, are so helpful. A letter that he wrote to believers in Rome, he says, "We know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." In all things, good things, bad things, happy things, sad things, beautiful things, ugly things. In all things, God is working for your good, for your rescue, for your restoration in Jesus. So you can trust him. You can trust him. So let me put this on the screen here for people that like to take notes. When life feels like it is spinning out of control, God is absolutely in control and working for your good. Whatever is going on in your life. And I would just challenge you to focus on three things here, three statements. And it's this right here. See him, listen to him, trust him. That woman with the perfume, what did she do? She really saw him. She really listened to him. And it gave her the perspective. And this final scene, God is on his throne. You can trust him. So whatever is going on in your world, I would just leave with these three statements. See him, hear him, trust him. So let's wrap up by talking about the climactic scene of the Bible, the climactic scene of all human history. This is what we're headed toward in this series. We're going to be focusing in on these final hours. And I really hope you come back next week. You got to come back next week because we'll start our time here at the table with the Last Supper, and we'll move to what I think is the favorite place for Jesus and his disciples when they were in Jerusalem. It's a garden. It's an olive grove. It's called the Garden of Gethsemane. And what we see in these moments, I think, is just absolutely incredible. So please come back next week as we continue the series. And as we close, I'd love to just pray for you. Heavenly Father, you gave us your Son. And in this season, we look forward to the cross. We look forward to Easter, the resurrection. And God, as we walk through the moments leading up, God, we just want to see your Son. Help us to really hear the words of your Son and help us to trust you in all things. God, this is our prayer, and we pray it in the name of Jesus. Amen. Hey, we'll see you next weekend.